Time now for KRWG's Gardening Confidential on 90.7 FM and KRWG.org. Hi, I'm Edwin Resendez. Join us as we take a break from political talk to discuss an issue that is important to us all in the desert. What makes your desert garden grow in the fall? Our special guest is Jeff Anderson, who is an agricultural agent with the Cooperative Extension Service at New Mexico State University. We'll be discussing plants to plant in the fall, where to plant them, to when to water them. Ask your questions or give us your gardening tips at 575-646-2212 or join KC Counts at our social media desk with your questions or tips. All calls and social media questions will be entered into a drawing for a $100 gift card to Sierra Vista Growers. You can watch the show live on Facebook as we live stream it. KRWG's Gardening Confidential is on after the news. KRWG's Gardening Confidential on 90.7 FM and KRWG.org is brought to you by Pickwick, with a Santa Fe Grill in most locations and Peaky Treats available in Las Cruces. Pickwick, serving southern New Mexico since 1958. By Mesilla Valley Hospice, serving generations of families during difficult times. Mesilla Valley Hospice is made possible through donations and the support of the entire community. Learn more online at mvhospice.org. By Sierra Vista Growers, located in La Union in Mesilla Valley, stocked with plants and local products. Fall planting season is here. More at sierravistagrowers.net or on Facebook. Good afternoon, I'm Edmundo Resendez. It is time now for KRWG's Gardening Confidential. 575-646-2212, 575-646-2212, or you can join KC Counts at our social media desk with your questions or gardening tips. My guest is Jeff Anderson, who is an agricultural agent with the Cooperative Extension Service at New Mexico State University. Jeff, welcome back.
Thank you, Edmundo.
The fall edition.
Yeah.
Because spring is one growing season, then we've got the fall.
Spring, and fall is here now.
Okay, so how was the spring season? And by the way, all calls and social media questions will be entered into a drawing to win a $100 gift card to Sierra Vista Growers. You can watch the show live on Facebook as we live stream it. We've got two $100 gift cards that we're going to give away at the end of the show. So going back to the question, how was spring and how was summer?
So spring seemed like a blur right now. Mm-hmm. But I think if I remember correctly, it was really a nice spring. I at least I enjoyed it, and I think gardening was good. Summer this year, though, I think we just did not have a monsoon season. I don't know, maybe some people got some rain, but for me, very little rain.
I had this conversation with a lot of people, with our engineer, as a matter of fact. He said, yeah, it rained here in the university area, but up on 70, there were times when these clouds would form and they just would not let the rain go.
Right. So, you know, some people got rain and the rain came down and you got a nice dose there. But that rain didn't last very long, you know, maybe not in duration, but it also didn't last very long. Once it put down the water on the earth, it evaporated away.
So what tips do you have for people during the summer when it just won't come out in rain and you've got water restrictions?
And I know the water department probably doesn't like it, but it's a matter of water, water, water. And you got to understand your soil type. So if you have heavy clay soil, maybe a little less water and not as often. But if you have real sandy soils, you have to do much more in the way of frequency, because the sandy soils are going to dry out really quickly. So you got to really pay attention to your soils and use mulches.
Mulch, mulch, mulch.
Yep.
575-646-2212. 575-646-2212. Or you can join KC Counts at our social media desk with your questions or gardening tips. Let us go to the phone lines. We've got Gina standing by. Gina, welcome to KRWG's Gardening Confidential.
Hi, Gina. Am I on?
Yes, you are, Gina.
Okay.
Welcome.
Hi, Jeff. This is Tina Smiley. First of all, I want to thank you so much for giving us your time and your expertise. I've been anxious to talk to you. So, Jeff, I want to know what information, what advice you would give me for transplanting an oleander. I have a very large oleander in my yard, and I need to move it from one area to another, because I want to use that space for something else, but I also want to take care of the oleander. I don't want to kill it. I want to transplant it as gently and as properly as possible. What do you recommend? Now, I am in the middle of town. I have sandy soil. I mean, what do you recommend? I need to move it within the next couple of weeks. Is that going to be detrimental to my oleander?
Okay. So, first off, good luck moving it. If it's a big oleander, they're well anchored into the ground. They do put down pretty deep roots. Your advantage is that you have sandy soil, so it'll be a lot easier to dig in than if you had caliche or heavy clay soil.
Yes, okay.
The other advice is maybe you want to get some help. I know that Aggies Without Limits at NMSU here has people that sometimes come out and help you for a small fee. And that's the way they earn money. But, yeah, the big problem is going to be digging it up. And this time of year, you know, you're looking at moving it this time of year. It's not the ideal time of moving it. It would be better in the early spring, maybe in April, when the weather is going to stay warmer. But if you have to move it right now, that's a difficulty one. So you want to cut it back somewhat. You don't want to encourage too much growth after you cut it back because it's going into fall. But you want to cut enough around it that you can get in there and be able to dig around it and dig it up. I wouldn't worry about being too gentle with it. Our soils are warm, so it's more likely to root back out after you transplant it. So dig the hole first, get it dug up somehow, drag it or however you can move it into the position you want it, get it in there, and then get the soil in there and water it really well. You don't have to any fertilizers or anything special. Just keep it really well watered so it roots back out. And you may have to kind of protect it through the winter this year.
Right.
Normally, you probably wouldn't have to, but because it's so late in the year, you may have to protect it.
When you say protect it, are you talking about at the ground level, protecting the root ball under the ground, or are you talking about protecting the entire plant?
Well, if it's really, if it's pretty big, it's kind of hard to protect the whole plant. So if you can pile leaves around the base of the plant or something to protect the crown, because you probably will get some freeze back damage that you'll have to cut off in the spring. But the main thing is to keep it watered so that it can root back out into the soil.
And would you recommend a root stimulator?
It's really not necessary. You know, you've got a big, massive amount of the plant that's going to push roots out pretty quickly.
Okay.
Great, Gina.
Very good. Thank you.
Good
so
luck
much
with that.
You're very welcome.
Call us back in the spring and let us know how it turned out.
Okay, I will. Thanks.
All right.
Bye-bye.
575-646-2212. 575-646-2212. Again, we are live streaming the show on KRWG's Facebook page, so make sure you like it and you can ask your questions or your comments on our Facebook page. Again, all social media questions and calls will be entered into a drawing for a $100 gift card to Sierra Vista Growers in La Union. Let us welcome Tricia. Tricia, welcome to KRWG's Gardening Confidential. You're on with Jeff.
Thank you.
What's your question, Tricia?
Oh, I'm sorry. You're on. Means you're on.
Yeah, that means you're on. You're live on the air.
All right. My son has a pomegranate tree in his backyard, and I am from the northern part of the state, and we don't have any pomegranate trees, so I don't know what to do about this pomegranate tree. At first, he thought it wasn't getting enough water, and so he watered it and watered it with all his heart. And then he went to the nursery, and they said, oh, no, the only thing that will kill it is water. So this year, he stopped watering it, and he had blooms all over it, and he had fruit all over it, and then the fruit split open and fell off. Where did we go wrong?
So the pomegranate, first off, is native to the Mideast, and it is very, very drought tolerant. It'll put down pretty deep roots. So while it can survive without being watered, that's not a good thing. It should receive periodic water in order for the fruit to grow properly. So if you don't water it, the fruit's going to grow, and then we'll get a rainy event, or if you gave it water, and it's going to take up water really fast, and the fruit will split open. So consistent watering keeps the fruit from splitting open. But when it gets to fall, the fruit's going to split open no matter what because it'll be ripe, and that's how it disperses the seed for the birds. It opens up the fruit so that they can get in there and eat it. I haven't heard that one that if you overwater it, you'll kill it. Maybe if it was newly planted and you drowned it, it would do that, or if it was in real heavy clay soil. But periodic watering is really important for the pomegranate to do well here. But they are very drought tolerant as well.
how do you know when the fruit is ripe? I want to make some pomegranate jam, and we were waiting to make sure that it was ripe, and then it split up, and then it was too ripe.
Okay, so one of the ways to know is the time of year, and most pomegranates are going to start ripening in September, so it's just basically knowing the variety. Wonderful generally goes from a green to a much redder color, but there are some pomegranates that are red almost all year round, so it's difficult to tell. So, you know, if you have enough pomegranates, you kind of set your own season. You know when they're going to about split. So generally you figure mid-September they're going to be ready, and you can kind of take a pomegranate off and open it up and see if it's at the stage you want. Once they start splitting, you definitely know they're pretty much ripe.
Okay. Next, one more question.
Okay, Tricia.
What sort of fertilizer does it like?
Are you in sandy soil? What kind of soil are you in?
I think his soil is clay.
Okay.
He lives up off of Elks Road.
Okay, up of Elks Road. It's probably a sandier soil up there, since it's a little bit on the mesa up there.
Okay.
So sands don't hold much in the way of fertility, so you might want to use like in April, and you probably only need to do it one time, like a 16-8-8, which is a locally made fertilizer here and adapted for our soils here. But just a basic fertilizer, like not too high in nitrogen. They're pretty good at scavenging up their own food out of the soils, the elements that are available there. So they don't need too much fertilizer.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank
we'll
you,
try
Tricia.
Try again next year.
Good luck
Thank
with
you.
That. Thank you, Tricia. Call us in the spring and let us know how it went. Our guest is Jeff Anderson, who is an agricultural agent with the Cooperative Extension Service at New Mexico State University. I am at Mundo Resendez. We are here to answer your questions. Well, Jeff is here. I'm just here to guide him to answer your questions about your desert garden and how it can blossom in the fall. Let's move beyond xeriscaping on KRWG's Gardening Confidential, 575-646-2212. 575-646-2212. Or you can join us on social media where we have Casey Counts standing by. Casey, let us welcome you to KRWG's Gardening Confidential. What are people saying on social media?
Thank you, Edmundo. Well, we don't quite want to move past xeriscaping just yet.
Okay.
Teofeo Martinez chimed in and asked what the best time to trim palm trees and bushes in your xeriscaping is.
Palm trees and bushes. You know, palm trees are some of my favorite
yes.
plants. I have like over 500 in my yard.
500?
500 palm trees, yes. I lost count after 500. But palm trees generally, you want to consider pruning them as needed, and generally in the spring, and then through the summer only as maybe a dead frond folds down or it's interfering with a walkway and you need to trim it up. But every leaf on a palm is really important for its winter survival. And there are palms that can take 15 below zero, and there are palms that are tropical. So there's usually a palm for New Mexico here for anybody interested in them. And bushes, what was the other one?
Trimming
bushes. Again, in the spring. And that's for most of the country. Spring trimming is usually the best unless it flowers in the spring, and then you want to wait till after it flowers so that you enjoy the flowers. But generally, you don't want to be trimming bushes late in the fall this time of year because it's only 3 or 4 weeks before maybe we hit a frost, possibly. And so if you trim them now, then they'll put on new growth, and that new growth is going to get hit by the freeze, and it won't be, it'll be very unsightly.
Okay, Casey, do you have another one?
Yeah, in fact, Mr. Martinez had a second question that he followed up with. Buying succulents and other plants grown in greenhouses have done poorly, both outdoors and indoors. What's the best place to keep these once you bring them home?
So, you know, succulents are grown in greenhouses, and they're grown under real high humidity type conditions with no wind and no stress on them. So then you take them into New Mexico sun, and you go up to 11,000 plus candle foot light, and then they burn, or then winter comes and they freeze. So succulents, there's not a lot of what we think of as true leafy succulents that actually do well here in New Mexico. You know, either they're for California or they're for like the sempervivums. They're really good up in cold northern climates. So it's really hard to find those particular succulents. But you can grow them in pots. And if you buy them in the store, bring them home, keep them in partial shade. They need quite a bit of light, and kind of try to move them out to more and more sunlight along the way. But some of them, even in New Mexico here, can never be in full sun. So a lot of them, it's pot culture.
Pot culture. Okay, 575-646-2212. 575-646-2212. Jeff Anderson is our guest. He is an agricultural agent with the Cooperative Extension Service at New Mexico State University. Let us go to our phone lines where we have Barbara. Barbara, welcome to KRWG's Gardening Confidential. What's on your mind?
Hi, I have actually three questions. The first one is, does NMSU still have that wonderful New Mexico Extension office where one can get pamphlets on the right varieties and things to plant, in New Mexico?
Yes, that still exists. Every county in the state of New Mexico, all 33 counties, have an extension office where you can get assistance from the county agent and publications. But,
where is it located on the NMSU campus?
Oh, it's not on NMSU campus. Our office is at 1170 North Solano Drive, Suite M. So generally, you're not going to find an extension office located directly on campus. The county is tasked with housing them.
Thank you. My second, I did some graduate work at NMSU in the early 90s, and that office was just a wonderful source of material, so thank you for that. My second question is another transplanting question. I live in a house. I rent the house, so I don't own the property. There are two very large fig trees that are, one of them is right next to the house and caused a problem with the gas line. We've stopped watering it, but it desperately needs to be moved, and the other one's about four or five feet from the back door. It's been clumsily trimmed in the past. They're both still fruit bearing, and they both need to be moved, and they are quite large. I wondered if I heard the previous call about transplanting an oleander, but I wondered about figs.
Okay, so figs. Again, they have some deep roots there, so they're going to be difficult to dig out. There'll be a lot of roots. This is not, again, the ideal time to move them unless you absolutely had to. February would be a better time to move them if you can wait till then, so that you can organize things and move them then. And then you should be able to dig them up and try and get as much of the root system as you can and transplant them to the location that you're considering.
Okay. And the last question, what is the best way to get rid? I'm talking about a lot that is approximately 50 by 150 square feet. And all over the lot, except where the house is standing, there is silver leaf nightshade, and goat heads are ubiquitous. What is the best way, natural way, to start getting rid of them? Would that be by hoeing them or trying to pull them up by the root after the rain or what? I mean, it is a huge stand of silver leaf nightshade and also goat heads.
Right, right. So weeds are always a problem here in New Mexico. And the best way to naturally get rid of them, one is prevention. So getting rid of them before they form seed, because once they go to seed, one seed that starts one plant can produce hundreds, if not thousands, of other plants. So cutting off the seed supply, but the earth is a seed bank as well. So then, you're going to have constantly that coming up for some time. In the way of goat heads, it's a matter of pulling them out or hoeing them down. They're an annual, so you can control them that way. And I will mention you can use a pre-emergent herbicide. I know you were talking natural, but pre-emergent herbicide can really help in controlling the germination of those seeds and make life easier for you. And it's a little bit different than a post-emergent herbicide. As far as silver nightshade is a perennial plant with an extensive root system that if you were to apply a herbicide on it, it tends to shed that off, and it takes multiple applications to wipe it out. But you can do it naturally depending on how much you have and how much work you're willing to put in it. What you have to do is go out there and hoe it off or pull it out, but you need to do that like on an every 2 days. because once that plant puts up a new sprout with green leaves, it's putting energy back into its root system. So if you're going to do it naturally, it's a matter of starving out the root system. And if you can put a mulch down thick enough to keep them from coming through there, that would be good. But any part that escapes and gets into the light is going to make energy to make more roots.
Oh, thank you very, very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Barbara. 575-646-2212. 575-646-2212. Or join Casey Counts on our social media desk, where she is standing by ready to hear from you with your questions or comments or gardening tips. Let us go back to our phone lines. And by the way, all calls and social media questions will be entered into a drawing for a $100 gift card to Sierra Vista Growers in La Union. Thanks to them for providing us with the gift card. Let us go to our phone lines, where we have Albert standing by. Albert, welcome to KRWG's Gardening Confidential.
Hi, thank you.
What's on your mind, sir?
I just had a question about bugs. I planted some green zucchini earlier this year, and I got those little, like, I guess they call them zucchini bugs. They're kind of like little square-shaped bugs. How can I keep them from coming back?
That is one of the most difficult questions for summer gardeners growing squashes and all the different types of squash. Those are true stink bug type bugs or leaf-footed plant bugs that can get in there, and they really devastate your vines, and they can kill them with different diseases and that. How do you keep them away? You know, I work out at the prison, and we grow squash out there with the prisoners, and they're there all day long, so they can pick them off by hand. That's the natural, organic way. They go out every day, and they remove any that they find, and doing that has actually been really successful if you can do it organically. But if you don't have that kind of time, then you may have to resort to some chemicals. But there aren't many that are very effective against squash bugs. And seven is one. Some seven dust, that might be an option there. Does that help at all?
Some seven dust?
Right. There's a seven spray of liquid, but seven dust. A lot of times people dust their plants with seven.
And then you dust it right onto the plant. It won't harm the squash or poison me or my family.
No, not unless you eat it directly. So there's a disclaimer there. You got to follow the directions. So any kind of pesticide has a label, and that's a legal document that you have to follow. So it gives you the time interval from when you apply it to when you can eat it.
Yeah, because last year I planted them and I didn't have that problem. This year, all of a sudden, I got all these little bugs.
Right. Once they find it, they probably will have it for life. Yep.
Really?
All right. Thank you, Albert.
Oh, man.
All right. Hey, good luck with that. 575-646-2212. 575-646-2212. Or join us on social media. We are live streaming the show, where you can call, you can write in your questions or comments or gardening tips. Let us go to our phone lines to Fran. Fran, welcome to KRWG's Gardening Confidential. What's on your mind?
Well, I have two questions. I have lived here 7 years, and the crepe myrtles were doing fine, and they were here when I bought the house. And this year they've been suffering. At the same time, in the vicinity of those, I put in Oregon holly, I think grape holly, and a viburnum called snowball bush. And all of these get the same amount of water that they've always gotten over the 7 years. So I'm wondering, the new plants lose their leaves, get new ones, lose those, get some more new ones. And I'm wondering if you can pinpoint that with that small description. Is it needing more water maybe?
Now I can't answer the water one exactly without seeing your watering schedule, but I can tell you what possibly is going on there. I've been troubled with crepe myrtles looking bad for a long time. I've been here over 36 years and wondering why that is. But it has to do with, they are a non-native plant, and its genetics. There are two varieties, Natchez and Muskogee, that seem to do very well here under our conditions. After that, a lot of them suffer. There are hybrids between a Japanese and an Indian from India types.
Okay.
And they're sensitive to salt. So they get sensitive to salt. They get sensitive to micronutrient deficiencies. And we have both problems here in the state with high alkaline soils. So you combine all that together, and then with high-intensity sunlight, they tend to burn up. So they'll look nice for a while up until they flower, and then their leaves tend to shrivel up. And this year seems to be an exceptionally bad year for all of that, for many plants.
So it's not just me.
It's not just you. There are plants that I have grown for 30-some years and never seen scorch on them, and I know they get watered properly, that this year got scorched. And it's just our intense sunlight.
All right. Well, that does help on these new ones that were just planted last spring. Who knows? They're in the in partial shade, so it seems like they should do well without scorch, but they're still getting it. So.
Right.
The other question with two, I want to say not Mexican elder, a desert willow, and one Vitex that were pruned last January by someone using his own clippers. They have not done well at all, and the leaves, instead of coming out long, like they're usually 3 inches long, they've clumped up, and the ends of the branches all look dead. And I'm wondering if his clippers might have had a virus that would cause that. And I've looked at other desert willows around town and other Vitex, and they don't seem to have any problem. So it's just in my yard.
Right. So it's really not a virus, but it could be associated with a virus, but not necessarily from his clippers. There is a mite. And I was trying to think of what the name of the mite was, but it's a mite.
It's a mite.
It's a mite. Starts with an E. And if I had an entomologist here, I'm sure they could tell me.
okay.
Areophid. I think it's in the Areophid group. It's an Areophid mite. And that's been attacking in different parts of the city, in some places extremely severe, with like almost every plant in the yard. And there really is no treatment. It's a microscopic mite that gets in between the new buds and the leaf bases and that. And it eats the cells in there and causes distortion and hormonal changes within the plant. And they're really, you could try dusting with sulfur. Sulfur's been used as a miticide. I'm not sure how effective that would be, and sulfur's pretty natural. But there isn't really a treatment for that particular mite.
So just prune these bushes, or trees actually, not severely but thoroughly, and let them start over? Because they're not dying, they're just funny looking.
The mites like to feed on new growth, so pruning them, you're going to get new growth. So
yeah,
it's a difficult thing.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, friend.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
575-646-2212. 575-646-2212. Jeff Anderson is our special guest. He is with the Cooperative Extension Service at New Mexico State University. I'm Edmundo Resendez. You are listening to KRWG's Gardening Confidential on 90.7 FM and KRWG.org. Let us welcome Tricia. Tricia, you are on with Jeff Anderson.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
I'm calling back because I have some advice for the lady who's looking to get rid of her goat heads.
Okay.
Okay, first of all, that's really difficult. My punishment when I was a child was if I did something wrong or bad, depending on the degree, I had to go out in the backyard and pull goat heads. So I consider myself somewhat of an expert for my sins. All right. The thing about goat heads is you can't pull them and leave them there or cut them and leave them there, because they will go ahead and produce seeds, and then all of that has been for nothing. You have to keep a really sharp eye on them and pull them as soon as they stick their nasty little heads through the soil. It is an ongoing thing. I live in a house that had lots of goat heads in the backyard. I moved in 4 years ago. I got every one of them out, and there are still goat heads out there, but I patrol. Make sure you pick up all of those little, I don't know what you call them, a seed pod, that has the actual heads that look like goats. There's usually four of them on a pod, I think, maybe five. Anyway, pick up all of those because every one of those goat heads will make a new goat head city. So as far as I've been able to tell, there is nothing. When I was little, I heard that salt would kill them. I swiped salt from my mother's pantry and put it on the goat heads, and they said, oh, boy, have you got any pepper? So you just have to keep after it, and there's nothing that will get rid of them except picking them, pulling them out by the roots, picking them up and putting them in a bag and sending them to the dump. And I feel your sorrow, my sister.
Okay, thank you very much, Tricia.
You know, I forgot to mention one thing. There is a goat head weevil, and I think you can go online at goathead.com or something like that, and you can get this weevil. There is a natural weevil. Now, it's not 100% effective and how well it does in the heat here, but it has been used in different parts to help control, not necessarily eliminate them all, but help control.
All right, Jean, welcome.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Let us go to Jean, who is standing by. Jean, welcome to KRWG's Gardening Confidential. What's on your mind, Jean?
Hi there. I have a broom. I do not know what variety. It volunteered, and we're compatible, so I decided to let it stay. And it's several years old and quite large. And starting about 2 years ago, year and a half ago, it started developing witch's broom. I pruned off a lot of the witch's broom, but as new growth comes in, eventually a new witch's broom forms. So I'm thinking that I'm going to have to dig out perhaps the whole broom plant and just give it up. And I know that witch's broom is caused by different things in different plants. So I'm wondering if you have any idea what causes a witch's broom in a broom plant.
Yeah, depending on what kind of broom we're talking about, and there's a lot of different plants called broom, it could be the areophid mite, or it could be a zinc deficiency, depending on what it is. I do know that Spanish broom, which is one with the beautiful yellow flowers, are real fragrant, like in May. That particular one gets Genista caterpillars that eat it and kill them off. It will actually kill the plant because they eat the stems off and kill the plant. And so does yours bloom at all?
It blooms. The blooms are white.
Okay.
I'm thinking it's some sort of wild type out of the desert.
Yeah, it sounds like a Baccharis. It sounds like the desert broom called Baccharis, B-A-C-C-H-A-R-I-S, which is more native to Arizona, but because of maybe climate change, if we think that or want to talk, it has become much more prevalent here. It didn't used to be here, but now it's like becoming part of our native desert here. So,
all right, thank you, Gene.
Okay.
Thank you for
calling. All right.
All right, good luck. 575-646-2212, 575-646-2212, or join us on social media where we have Casey Counts ready to hear from you. Speaking of Casey Counts, let us go to her right now on social media. Casey, what are people saying?
Hi, Bob and Melissa have 3-4-foot pistachio trees. Bob says he picked them up in February from Alamo, and they look good. He has the little good-looking symbol here. But what should I do, he says, to prep for winter so that they make it to spring?
Well, there isn't really much of anything you need to do. If they're very tiny, you may want to consider painting the trunks with white latex paint. And what that does is reflect the sunlight off in the wintertime so they don't heat up and cause what we call southwest injury, where the cells burst open on one side of the tree because of the sun heating it up and then the freezing, you know, freeze-thaw. So that may be a consideration. Otherwise, just make sure you've watered them. They're very drought-tolerant, and since they're new, you want to make sure that they receive some kind of a little bit of moisture all winter long so that the roots don't dry out and they can keep forming. That should be it.
Okay, what else?
Pat Minjarez talked about their summer garden and said it gave them squash and tomatoes and beautiful sunflowers. And now they have pumpkins growing, but they're having a problem with a garden bed that has grass growing in it. And they're asking for suggestions on how to get rid of it without using harmful agents.
All right, Casey. Isn't that the question we get every time we do one of these?
Everybody wants a magic wand.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's called work with a hole. So if you don't want to use chemicals, the only way to really do it is get in there and either, depending on how big it is, plow it up and keep it plowed. Because like I said, with all those, you know, if you're looking at grass, and it sounds like probably it's going to be Bermuda grass. Bermuda grass, the wild kind, can put roots down 5 feet deep in the soil.
5 feet?
5 feet. And like the hybrids, they can go at least 3 feet. So, you know, you got quite a depth there to cover. And what you need to do is starve it out. And if you really want to get rid of Bermuda grass, let's talk a little bit about it. And this may involve chemical a bit. But if you want to get rid of Bermuda grass, the best time to do it is right now. It's September. Actually, a couple weeks earlier would have been a little bit better. But, you know, you can start using chemicals, or you can start plowing it up and keeping any green off of it. So if you can keep all the green off of your grass, those perennial weeds, this time of year, it's easier to starve them out before winter, because in winter they'll go dormant. So if you starve them out before they can go winter, they can't put away the reserves to come back next spring. And they'll be very weak if they even come back next spring, and then it's easier to get rid of them.
All right, let us go to back to our phone lines. Karen, welcome to KRWG's Gardening Confidential. You are on with Jeff.
Hello.
Hello, Karen.
Hi. It seems I've been growing my garden a few years now, and some years are successful and some are not. This year, I watered everything and put some shade up, and everything was looking good, mainly my tomatoes, and I had watermelon, kale, lettuce, little likes, and some of it fruited and some of it didn't. But with my tomatoes, I'm noticing that all the greenery looks really good. My blossoms turn into small tomatoes, and I'll quit watering when it's looking good. We can have a super hot day, and I'll have burn on those leaves up top, so I water it again. And then within a day or two or three, my fruit gets this rot. The tomatoes are rotting from, like, half of them are rot. I'm wondering if I'm overwatering because the top leaves are dry. I don't know what to do.
If you want to grow great tomatoes, you have to have consistent watering. And that may involve, depending on your soil type, watering every single day and up to twice a day. If we were running into the 100-degree temperatures, you need to water a little bit in the morning, a little bit in the evening. We're not talking about leaving the hose run. I've heard people say, I leave it run for an hour. You don't need to leave it run for no hour. You know, you just
like
need
flood
to wet
irrigation. No.
Yeah, you just need to wet up that soil profile, and you know, if you can only get by with once a day, so be it. But twice a day can be good. It's a matter of keeping that soil moisture even, small amounts, and keeping it even. So during the summertime, we can lose a third to a half an inch of water per day just evaporating away.
Mm-hmm.
Our annual evaporation rate is 93 inches, mm-hmm. and our rain is 8 or 10 inches, like they say now, but when I was here, uh-huh. it used to be 8 inches. So we can really evaporate things away, and that's due to our elevation, clear skies, and low humidity like that. It just evaporates.
So what would cause the tomatoes to start rotting on the vine?
So what happens is that When you have water and the water is getting into the tomato, it's bringing this nutrition, especially calcium, with it a lot of times. And that calcium is what strengthens the cells of the tomato. And you may have heard of blossom end rot, where the end of the tomato rots. If not enough calcium gets to those ends, those cells collapse. So if the tomato itself gets droughted too, those cells collapse. And then you try to rehydrate them, but they've already collapsed. And so you've got damaged tissue, and then you put water on damaged tissue, it's going to rot.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have consistency.
The plant itself looks real green, but the fruit rots. And then my Walker melon was looking great. It was the size of a large softball or larger, and I watered, and that I would flood irrigate. And one good hot day, I went out and looked, and all the leaves were brown and dead. And I watered, and the same thing happened to that one. So would you say it's I just let it go too long without with evaporation? I don't know.
You know, it's hard to say. There are multiple factors there. So if it's sitting in heavy clay soil, the moisture when you water from the soil and everything can cause disease problems and bacterial problems, and that can induce rot. It can, you know, it could splash water up on the fruit or onto the leaves and cause rot. Or it can just flat out get way too dry, and then you bring in water, and of course, then it's going to rot.
All right. Thank you very much, Karen.
Thank you.
All right. You have a good day. 575-646-2212. 575-646-2212. Denise, welcome. You are on with Jeff Anderson. Thank you for your patience.
Yes. I have a number of Afghan pines on my property, and this summer has just really been terrible. They've dropped a number of pine needles in my yard, and I can see there's more that are ready to drop. So my question is, for the fall and winter, how do you recommend? During the summer, I would water slowly for like just dribble and then move to the next tree, but that didn't seem to help with this heat and no monsoon. So I want to do the best that I can for them for the fall and winter.
Okay, so a lot of people think Afghan pines are like desert and drought tolerant.
No, I know they're not, from mountains.
yeah, they're kind of up in elevation. They're in Afghanistan and southwest Russia and that. So they do need water, so that's really critical. And when you want to water at least at the drip line of the tree. And you want to water on a consistent basis. They're almost like any other tree. While they can take drought, they're not invincible. And if they're stressed, in 2011, we had the big freeze where we dropped below zero, and then we've had drought, and we've had all this happening. And so even healthy trees have been subject to borers, and we have huge borer infestations, especially in Afghan pines throughout the valley, and they will kill a tree pretty easy, even a healthy tree. So what you need to do is inspect the trunk, and if the tree is thinning and thinning and thinning and you're watering it and it's still thinning and looking sparser and sparser, more than likely you've got borers in there that are cutting off the water supply to the tree. And if you don't treat it, and this is where the difficult thing is for people that don't believe in chemicals, if you don't treat it, it's going to die. I guarantee it will die. So, but you have to use a systemic insecticide to treat the tree, to kill the borers inside the tree, to stop that advancement.
Thank you, Denise. Good luck. 575-646-2212. 575-646-2212. We'll be going to our social media desk in just one moment. Let us go to John. John, welcome to KRWG's Gardening Confidential. You're on with Jeff Anderson.
Hi, Jeff. This is John from Mesilla. You've been to my place. My question is about getting rid of ancient trumpet vines that keep growing up from the roots 20, 30, 40 feet away from the plant. I know this is a good time of year to spray, but I'm having trouble with some of the old standards don't work on trumpet vines. What are some good killers, stump killers, brush killers?
Boy, I'm starting to sound like a chemical agent here. it's a matter, you know, you would have, naturally, for the people that are very natural and want to stay 100% organic, you have to keep pulling them out and you have to really go after that and keep all green away from it. For those of you who consider chemicals, and I'm going to say the R word, or I could say the G word, glyphosate and not Roundup, it can be very effective, but it takes multiple applications of spraying it, but there are some stronger brush herbicides that are get into the 2,4-D dicamba type class that you can put on there. They're broadleaf herbicides. And I have a little more fear of broadleaf herbicides than I do of Roundup, because Roundup, when it hits the soil, it's attached to the soil and broken down by the sun. It doesn't move through the soil profile. Generally, broadleaf herbicides will move down through the soil profile and can affect other plants or can get into your water system. But if you really have something like that you really need to get rid of, in this case a trumpet vine, or it could be a tree of heaven, there are some really strong herbicides that can be used. And I won't go into them on the line here, but there are strong ones. If you want to call our office, I can help you out with that.
Okay. John, we got to get to some other callers. Thank you very much for calling in. 575-646-2212. By the way, this is a two-hour show. It goes on 12 to 2 for those of you that are wanting to call in. You know, we've got some calls that are standing by, but we are also taking calls into the 1 o'clock hour. Let us go to a social media desk where we've got Casey Counts standing by. Casey?
Thanks, Edmundo. We had a couple of questions that I wanted to address before time ran out from folks who actually chimed in before we went to air. One from Ruth Rose, who says, now that the night temperatures are going down and we're in fall approaching winter, it seems a good time to consider how to adjust irrigation to support the plants through to the spring, the frequency, duration of watering in a freeze, she asks.
Okay, thank you, Ruth. I know who Ruth is. She's one of my master gardeners.
Yeah, okay.
And the master gardeners are out at the Southern New Mexico State Fair until Sunday, which is going on. But so you got to consider the plants that you're using in your soil type. So there are a number of plants like cactus, your ocotillo, your Texas sage. They're not going to need any water through the winter months. In fact, putting water on them in the winter months can be very detrimental, including like Lantana or Tacoma, the yellow bells, Esperanza. So you got to know which kind of plants that you have. On the other hand, then you have plants like we just talked about Afghan pines or southern live oaks and things like that. So most plants that we typically think of are bushes or yard plants, whether they're evergreen or dormant. Your dormant plants, even though they're dormant, I mean, a lot of people say, I turn off all the water for all winter. That's not good because their root systems are still alive. They still need a certain percentage of water, although it's not very much because they're technically dormant. But the roots grow all winter. Your evergreens, on the other hand, still need a percentage of water. We actually have a publication in our office that helps define how much water a tree needs per year, and it's a really great resource. That you can either pick up at our extension office or we can mail it out to you. But knowing the plant, that's the key thing, and knowing your soil. But generally, as an overall rule, for the winter months, I would say skip all those deserty, drought, super drought tolerant plants. Your mesquite shouldn't even be watered during the year. Mm-hmm. But those other plants like Japanese euonymus, your oak trees and different things like that, minimally, if they're established, water them once a month and give them a good soaking once a month through the winter.
Okay, what else you got, Casey?
We have a three-parter from a new resident to Albuquerque who has a couple of questions. Are there any edible flowers that grow well in that area in fall and winter? They like to use them for plantings in the kitchen. And she says, if I harvest rose hips, will that decrease rose flowering next year? And finally, this year, our grapevine leaves got consumed by some small white bug, not aphids or whiteflies, over the summer. Is there anything we can do over the fall and winter to protect it going forward? Would love some grape leaves and grapes in 2020.
Okay, first one. First one was?
What was the first one, Casey?
Edible flowers.
Edible flowers. So she's in Albuquerque?
Albuquerque.
So I'm not as familiar with Albuquerque, but I do know pansies are edible as long as you don't spray them with stuff. And they're one of the toughest plants you can use. There are ornamental cabbages and kales, but they're, a lot of that stuff, calendulas, are only cold hardy down to about 25. Pansies can take more. You can use Swiss chard is really attractive and much more cold hardy. So there are things like that you can use.
All right, what's the second question?
About the rose hips. If she harvests them, will that decrease rose flowering next year?
No, it actually increases flowering because you take, if you harvest those rose hips off right away, then you take the energy that's going into making the seed and the hip away and it goes back into flowering.
Third question.
And it was about the grapevine leaves. They got consumed by a small white bug. She said it was not aphids or white flies over the summer.
Probably leafhoppers. That's the most common insect on grapes are leafhoppers. They have a lot of people mistaken for white flies, but you can control them with different sprays, either 7 or imidacloprid.
All right, let us get Joshua in on the conversation. Joshua, you are on with Jeff Anderson.
Hi, my name is Joshua, and I've been gardening here for the past few years. I actually have a pretty large garden. It's about half an acre, and I have it on drip. And the first couple years were great as far as producing and stuff. I'm up towards the mountains, and I was getting a lot of watermelons and stuff. But this year, it was all actually all the cucurbits, the melons, my winter squash, and even my zucchini. It all started growing and got, you know, up above the ground about a foot or so, and then everything just, and then it's either some of them just stopped growing and stayed that size all summer long, and like the watermelons just dried up, and like they started to yellow at the edges of the leaves and dried up, yeah, nothing in that family did well this year.
Okay, thank you,
so,
Joshua.
My suggestion, and we always suggest in the extension service that you do a plant tissue test to find out what's going wrong, and that's usually in the way of micronutrients and macronutrients. But from my experience here, with repeated watering, it goes back to your nutritional program. So you know you could put on NPK, which is nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, which is common to do that for a lot of things. But and that will help with the growth really well, and you got to do it right. But there's also the micronutrients, and most people don't think of the micronutrients, and they're critical for proper growth. And our soils, being alkaline, are deficient in zinc, iron, manganese, and some of the other micronutrients.
All right, let us squeeze in.
I applied manure from our horses and cows that I have out here. I'm on a little ranch, but I apply manure every spring and fall.
Yeah, manure is going to give, I'll tell you, manure will give you the organic matter. It gives you some nitrogen, but it doesn't have the micronutrients in it. And manure is very high in salt. So if you put too much manure on, you're really salting the soil, and that will cause your plants to burn. So you got to be real careful with your manures, too.
Okay, so you just buy micronutrient mixes? Is that the only way of getting micronutrients?
They're difficult to get. Some of the stores, you know, if you want to be organic, you have to go into those like sea kelps and fish emulsion fertilizers if you want to go that way.
Sure.
The other way, if you're going to go the other nutritional, there are STEM, standard trace element mix, that's water soluble, that you can add for injection. There's different ones around. Quite a few on the internet if you look.
Okay, Joshua, okay. Thank you very much. We got to get to some other callers. 575-646-2212. We will be going into the 1 o'clock hour. So for those of you that have been waiting, we'll get to you in just a bit. Let us go to Jack. Jack, you are on with Jeff Anderson.
Yes, sir. My name is Jack, and I'm calling about a couple of things. Elder Rocka Pines, I have planted quite a few, about five of them in my dog area, because I've lost a lot of trees where they are. Now, they do pee on the trees and stuff, the young Eldorakas, and are they killing them, or is something else going on, do you think?
Why, are the trees suffering?
Oh, I've got, four out of five have already died.
Okay, dog urine has a lot of salt and urea in there. And so, you know, that if you're not leaching it out by watering with clean water and washing that down, it's going to build up and it's going to start burning the roots and killing back any kind of tree.
Okay. Well, I've been watering every day or every morning and most every night, but I don't think it's sinking in. So, but that helps a lot. I don't think, is there a better tree to plant in a dog area? Because they need some shade, and I prefer natural type of shade trees and so forth, and I just wondered if there was a better suggestion perhaps than Eldorakka pines. I don't want to do this again to the pines. The other pines I planted are doing well.
Okay, thanks, Jack.
If you're looking to cover a dog kennel type area there where you have animals, a mesquite, they put down really deep tap roots and they're broad spreading, and that would give really good shade, something like that. And you wouldn't have to worry about the watering, or I don't think the dog urine would bother it a whole lot.
All right, Carlene, we're going to squeeze you in. Carlene, what's on your mind?
Hi. Hi. I was just wondering, can I plant native wildflowers now, perennials, you know, like coneflower and, you know, plants like that to bloom in the spring? Can I do that this time of year?
Thanks, Carlene.
Yes, although coneflower is not necessarily native here, we have a number of different ones. Being that we're such a dry desert, generally they're very ephemeral, so they'll come up and you have to supply water and they're temporary. But now is a good time to get them established because we're not facing the heat and evaporation, so you can get the roots established. And some things just do better up in sandy soils, especially native wildflowers. Penstemons do really well up there. If you get in the heavy clay soils, then it becomes a more of a problem as to what will grow there properly.
Jeff, let us talk about how people can get a hold of you and the Extension office and talk to me about the Master Gardener hotline.
Okay. So our office, I mentioned it before, is at 1170 North Solano Drive, Suite M, and we're in the public county health building there. So we've been there for about 3 or 4 years. So you can get us there. Our phone number is 575-525-6649. I kind of laugh because I think of all the calls I get, and I've been away. I was at a conference. I came back to 600 and some different, you know, emails and calls and things like that. So, but that's where you can get me there. And our Master Gardeners are there on Tuesdays and Fridays from 9 to 12.
Okay, we are coming up on 1 o'clock. You are listening to KRWG Las Cruces, KRXG Silver City, broadcasting from the beautiful campus at New Mexico State University. We'll continue with KRWG's Gardening Confidential after the news.